So we are, we're actually all here today because one person is not in town. Next time we do the presentations, you guys give presentations of your work, of your intended work, and we all then criticize you and tell you that it's a complete waste of time and you totally misconceived it and so on and so forth. And we will, I was just thinking, well, we could do them in alphabetical order, but you're free to switch around. We have five people who will be presenting in 80 minutes. So that's 16 minutes apiece. So let's say they're 15-minute presentations. And I was just thinking of doing them in alphabetical order. The next time after that, Claire Rush, who's out of town today, will do her presentation first up. So anyway, that's what's going to happen. So I think the order would be, if I remember correctly, that you go first, letter C. you go letter F, so you go second. Letter M, third. Letter O, fourth. Letter Q, English letter anyway, fifth. Okay, but negotiate and switch, you know, all you want.
That's no problem.
And we'll have the projector here, and you can hook up a computer to it, or you can scribble on the board. So we'll do that. So, yeah, what I'm going to do this time is talk about optimal cell process called the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process. These are relevant. Ornstein-Uhlenbeck is relevant at all levels, but we're talking mostly about phylogenies. And I will be talking mostly not about specifically about phylogenies, but about a species or population evolving in a lineage, and what you expect from that. And it's the predominant way that selection comes into quantitative characters. Now, we talked last time about genetic drift of quantitative characters, and I argued that the genetic drift works out to be in directions proportional to the, well, it's in directions that are controlled by the additive genetic, the standing additive genetic variance and covariances in the population. So if you have like four characters, then you'd have a four-dimensional distribution. The additive genetic variation would show a normal distribution with contours, and basically, and that in turn, I think I showed, here it is for two dimensions, and this would be the additive genetic variance, the distribution of breeding values, which are the value that you estimate for an individual from the contribution of its individual copies of genes, and the covariation here is the additive genetic covariation. Genetic drift basically takes that and blows it up. That is, basically, the sampling and genetic drift goes along the same axes that this distribution has. It has principal axes. Here's the first principal component, the first principal axis. Here's the, it's badly drawn, should have crossed about there. The second one, it'll drift in this direction and that direction basically independently, just as the within population variation is independent of this direction and that direction. And genetic drift will cause some of that within species variation gets converted into between lineage variation. So that's what's really going on in genetic drift. The fact that individuals in the population are becoming more and more related to each other as a result of random mating in a small population means that the within species variation, in this case the additive genetic variation, is converted in the end into variation between lineages because they drifted off in different directions. So we had that. But now we have natural selection. And what I'm going to do is, well, first of all, show you a that there is a version of the classical breeder's equation, which I introduced to you in the very first lecture, or the second lecture, I think it was, which is the classical equation that came from Wright and Fisher in the 1920s and says that the change of a character is equal to the heritability times the selection differential. And I've already mentioned once earlier that Russ Landy in the 1970s and in subsequent work into the 1980s recast that for natural populations and said, well, what you can do is show that if you have a fitness curve which expresses the fitness of individuals of different phenotypes. So let me draw it over here because there's a couple of details worthy of note. So here's the trait, okay, the trait value. Here is a fitness curve. I'll just make it not particularly any normal shape or anything, just a lumpy bump. And we have a population, which is varying. We can draw it as a distribution on that trait. If you have that, then for each mean, for each value of the mean, which is here, this is the mean trait value, x with a bar over it. I think I better redraw that. I'll say trait, I'll put trait down here so we get it out of the way. And then we'll have our mean of our population. The mean of the population is there. Okay. There, then, if you go up here, you take each of these individuals, take each possible little slice here. You can figure out what its fitness is from the curve. You can imagine doing that. And you can say, well, there'll be a weighted average of those fitnesses, which will be the average fitness of individuals in the population. So there's going to be an average fitness curve. Generally speaking, the average fitness curve will be a bit less peaked than the individual selected surface. So it'll look generally similar, but since it's basically got a running average going across.
Yeah, if you've taken signal processing, it's a convolution.
Yeah, the convolution of the values up here with using this as the kernel. It's basically the distribution. And so what Russ is saying, he says, well, if you take that mean fitness curve and consider its derivative with respect to the mean phenotype, so as we move this thing across, given the amount of variation, we trace out a mean fitness curve. And as we look at different values of x bar, there are different values here. If you take the slope of that, so there's the slope at the point x bar. If you take the slope of the log mean fitness, I've drawn the, just the mean fitness, but there, you can also take it's a vertical log scale. And if you take the variance of the phenotype, and here it's for a single character, it turns out that the selection differential will be equal to that. So basically, if the slope is going up, the selection differential will be positive, and selection will be to the right. The slope is going down, the selection differential will be to the left. So he sort of reformulated this selection differential, which in its original animal breeding and plant breeding form is just a statement about the difference between the individuals that you're breeding from and the population from which they were selected. Here it's this fitness that does that selecting. And then he could basically show that this is the selection differential here. The response is the heritability times the selection differential, the ratio of the additive genetic variance over the total over the total variance, the phenotypic variance. When you multiply these, the VPs cancel out. And so what you end up getting is that the change in the character is equal to the additive genetic variation times the slope. So he sort of formulated things. Now I'm going to jump away from his map and do some separate math. This I've also, I think, showed you before, but we'll see it again. Suppose you take the fitness function of individual fitnesses, and you make it the shape of a normal distribution. This is done just for mathematical convenience. There's no biological law saying that fitness curves have to look like that. But we're looking for a curve that has a peak in the middle, it has some sort of an optimum phenotype, and it has fitness falling away on both sides. So if we say, okay, here's a fitness curve, now it's not a distribution. Nevertheless, it looks as if it is, and you can figure out what its standard deviation would be, and you can think of squaring that and having a quantity called V sub S. So it's a fictional variance. It's not the actual variance of anything that's variable. And it's a measure of the strength of selection. Because if V sub S is large, that means this curve is very wide. If the curve is very wide, natural selection is what? Strong or weak?
Weak.
So VS large means weak selection. VS small means strong selection. The limit would be VS getting down towards zero would mean everybody dies except individuals that are sitting right on the mean. So that's the limit of it. Well, here's what the curve looks like if we scale it so the peak is at one. The highest fitness will just, we're thinking of relative fitnesses, so we can take one of them and call it one, and let's just do that with the optimum. Well, then it turns out that if you take and I'm leaving out a whole bunch of algebra here, and the algebra, however, is just multiplying together normal distributions and completing squares and trying to get out a normal distribution. And then what you find is that if I put in a distribution, let's suppose my hand is a normal distribution, and we put the population under this selection, the will be pulled towards the optimum. And the amount of genetic response in the next generation will be that move times the heritability, and for reasons that I can explain separately later to anybody who wants, the multiplier that comes out is this thing. It's the additive genetic variance over this fictional selection variance plus the phenotypic variance. And basically, one way of looking, one particular case, suppose this distribution was really narrow, okay? Well, what it would say is everybody dies except the individuals that are right on the optimum. You might say, oh, well, that's perfect. That means they get all the way to the optimum in one generation of selection. But they don't. Because the individuals that are on the optimum aren't necessarily there for genetic reasons. They're partly there for environmental reasons. And so this thing, VS, would then be zero, basically zero. But the response would not be to go all the way to the optimum. It would be to go a fraction VA over VP, the heritability. So actually, even if you left only the individuals right on the optimum survive, everybody else dies. The population moves, but it moves part of the way to the optimum, and then you do the whole thing again in the next generation. So this thing here reflects both the strength of selection and the heritability. And this part here is the difference between the optimum and the mean, where the M here is the mean. What it says is the change is equal to a certain constant depending upon the strength of selection and the phenotypic and additive genetic variances times the distance to the optimum. So if the optimum is 2 centimeters above the mean phenotype, this difference here would be 2 on a scale of centimeters. Okay, so the other thing to notice here is that if we think of a population that has its additive genetic variance about constant, and its phenotypic variance about constant, And if the shape of the fitness curve is not changing, so VS is constant, this thing is a constant. So it basically says that the dynamics is going to be to move a constant fraction of the way to the optimum. If the optimum keeps sitting in the same place, you know, you move 10% of the way the first generation, 10% of that, of what remains the second, 10% of what remains the third, and so on. Okay. So that's the dynamics you have. And then you start thinking about a process undergoing natural selection of that sort and genetic drift. And what that's going to result in is the thing you're looking at will have a value. Now this, in this case, is going to be the mean phenotype equal to the old mean phenotype plus that change, which is some constant, that constant involving all those quantities, times the difference from the optimum. And then we're going to add on some genetic drift. We're going to say, okay, there's natural selection, pulls you there, and then when you go produce the next generation, well, also because of the finite number of individuals surviving, there's also some random perturbation. And that's this, and it's the variation due to genetic drift. So now we have a process that every generation moves a certain fraction of the way to the optimum, and then it has a sort of genetic drift, a perturbation that's maybe looks approximately normally distributed. Well, when you have a process that works like that, it's in discrete time. The time clock is going click, 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 and each time it jumps a certain fraction of the way to the optimum and then gets perturbed. Jumps and then gets perturbed. Now, that is a process that we call the, it's a version, it's a relative of the process called the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process. The Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process is actually a continuous time process with a lot of little infinitesimal jiggling, just like Brownian motion. The difference in the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process is it's always pulled towards the optimum value. There is some sort of a value that you're attracted to, and so it's been described as the Brownian motion of an elastically bound particle. You have a particle stretching a rubber band out to a post, and it's undergoing a Brownian motion, except that the rubber band is pulling it on average towards the post.
Okay.
Now this is a discrete version of it, and what you can show is that if these epsilons are normally distributed, that the that it, it interpolates the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process. It's like a samples at intervals of the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process. Yeah.
If you want a picture, it's on the website in the posting of chapter 2 of my book on page 129. It's this thing.
And is it, it's it, that
that's
thing presumably has an optimum right in the middle.
Yeah, the
somewhere.
Optimum is 0, 0.
So, yeah, well, I'll be showing
this is the
you,
discrete version.
I'll be showing you some actual simulations of it in a moment.
Sure.
So, now, one of the things you can show here, if you have a process, here's the optimum, and it's pulled towards the optimum, that if you let it go, it will wander around until it gets to the vicinity of the optimum and wander in both sides of it. And as it gets further away in either direction, it gets pulled back. On average, it will sit at that optimum. The whole thing is simply, linearly, hasn't got any squaring of things or logarithms of things or anything. It moves to the optimum, moves towards the optimum, gradually gets there, and then if you let it go long enough, it just indefinitely wanders around the optimum. And by taking expectations through this formula, noting that the expectation of epsilon is zero, you can work out that the expectation of x in the long run is just the optimum p. If the thing ends up centered at the optimum.
Can I make an epistemological point?
If the word doesn't scare you.
Yeah, the statement you just made assumes that the definition of the long run for the averaging is less than the definition of the longer run in which this value of p is changing. So there's an assumption that this concept of the optimum changes more slowly than whatever it is you're talking about in your data.
Now you're dragging reality in, for which I utterly condemn you.
Yeah, I know. And this is our continuing disagreement, but this is a good place to raise it.
We've got
two timescales.
But I get to decree the epistemology, so I decree that P doesn't change for the moment. Then we'll mention it later. But you're bringing in the real point of it'll move to the optimum on a certain timescale. And if you want to, and this will all be relevant when you're on that time scale, provided the optimum, as Fred said, hasn't changed very much in that time. Okay, so now we go on another step. I'm going to do a little bit of algebra in the next two slides that will just get you a feel for what the time scale of Ornstein-Uhlenbeck is. So, Ornstein-Uhlenbeck is a cousin of Brownian motion. It's just got this extra pull towards the optimum end. It and Brownian motion have the property that the distributions of things, like the conditional distribution of where you're at 10 minutes from now, given where you're at now, those are all normally distributed. They're easy. It's very easy to compute things like where you're going to be in a certain amount of time, covariation between where you're now and where you're going to be, and things like that. Those are very easy to compute for these. For continuous time stochastic processes, these guys are the most, this family of Ornstein-Uhlenbeck and Brownian motion ones are the ones that are tractable. And people will bring in lots of others. People will come to you and say, oh, I heard of this thing called the Levy process. Maybe this thing is changing according to a Levy process. Levy processes are things that do big jumps in a weird way. There are actually a whole class of them. There's not just one thing called the Levy process, but they all share the same thing. They're all pretty darned intractable to work with. They're great for people to raise objections from the back of seminars, but they're very hard to actually do anything with, whereas Ornstein-Uhlenbeck and Brownian motion are much easier. We're gonna use them for tractability.
Yeah, I did convince David Raup that Levy processes were real in the geological record, and OU processes were not. But you weren't in that argument.
I wasn't, and if I were there, I would say I'm disturbed because I know that genetic processes under these kinds of optimum selection do OU. And it's very hard to think of a way that they could do Levy processes except by having the optimum make wild jumps.
Right. But I use the word geological record there to indicate what time scale I was in.
Right.
And we're not in the breeding context anymore. This isn't human agriculture.
Well,
this is since the Cretaceous, that kind of time.
If we go back into my unreal world here, if you subtract V from both sides of the equation that I just gave you, it works out this way, which is to say that your departure from the optimum is equal to what it was in the previous generation times something, which is 1 minus this constant C. So if C is 0.1, so you're jumping 10% of the way to the optimum, 1 minus C will be 0.9. So it would be 9/10 as great as before. So then you have a process that's centered around zero being right on the optimum, and wandering, and it's just pulled by being multiplied by 1 minus C, and then a normal perturbation comes in. If you square both sides of the equation, now I'm skipping some steps here, if you square both sides of that equation and take expectations of everything, you will find there's a product term that drops out, and you will find that this thing, the expectation of the square of how far you are from the optimum, and remember, the optimum is also the long-term mean, so it's the square of your departure from the mean, its expectation, is equal to 1 minus C squared times that same thing in the previous generation, plus an expectation of the square of this genetic drift term. And those expectations of squares are variances. Those are the variances. So it says the variance around your mean, which is around the optimum, is equal to the old variance times 1 minus C squared with a variance of genetic drift added on. Okay. Now if you say to yourself, okay, what happens to this variance through time? You can get that because in a couple of steps of algebra, nothing really exciting, you can show that if you go forward t generations, if you start with a fixed point, and you start with, let's say, the population sitting right on the optimum, and it's going to undergo genetic drift and being pulled back towards the optimum. Its variance around the optimum after t generations is going to be this thing. It'll be the variance of genetic due to genetic drift times this is 1 plus the square of 1 minus c plus the fourth power of 1 minus c plus the sixth power of 1 minus c, blah, 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 up to the 2tth power of 1 minus c. Now, if you go to the limit, this power series just goes on indefinitely. And you will recall from your high school algebra, I hope, that if you have something that's 1 plus, let's call it b, plus b squared plus b cubed, and you keep going forever, bk plus dot, 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 off to forever, that's equal to 1 over 1 minus b. That's if b is, I believe, less than 1. Or greater than minus 1. Sorry.
Less than 1 in absolute value.
But this b thing is the fraction of the way, it's 1 minus the fraction of the way you jump to the optimum. So it's of the form 1 minus a positive quantity c, and that c isn't as big as 1, so it's okay. It follows those rules. So you get this. But the b in this case is 1 minus c quantity squared. So that's 1 over 1 minus the square of 1 minus c. So the variance, what will accumulate in the long run, is equal to the genetic drift variance divided by that thing. So it'll be some multiple of the genetic drift variance, but it'll be centered on the optimum. If c is small, which would be the case if you're looking at this process in a very fine grid, the variance will be equal to the variance of epsilon divided by 2c. Because this is 1 minus the quantity 1 minus 2c plus c squared. If we throw away the squared term, you basically get that. So that is what the long-term variance is. Now, suppose it were Brownian motion and not Ornstein-Uhlenbeck. Can somebody tell me something about what is the value c, for example, for Brownian motion?
Zero.
It's zero because there's no selection, so you're not being pulled anywhere. Okay. You're going a fraction c of the way to the optimum. If there's just Brownian motion, it doesn't matter. You could have an optimum sitting there, but if the fitness function is flat, there's no motion due to c. So then this formula does what? If c goes to zero, blows up. Okay. What can you say about the long-term variance? If here is the starting point, and then this thing starts undergoing Brownian motion, and I measure its variance around this optimum, in the long run, what happens to that variance? Variance of Brownian motion, when you wait t units of time, the variance of how far you wander, the average of how far you wander is zero, because on average you go neither left nor right. The variance, yeah, okay, you're imagining. This is what it looks like when he imagines, yes.
Is it linear? Is the increase in variance?
The variance increases linearly, yes. The standard deviation goes up as the square root.
Again, there's a picture of that in the handout you got in chapter 2.
Yeah. So, and the rationale, the simple rationale for it, took me a while to realize myself, was you sort of think, why doesn't the standard deviation go up linearly? And the answer is, because wherever it goes in the first, let's say, week of wandering, has a normal distribution with the standard deviation. If it were in another week of wandering to go twice as far, that would mean, it would mean basically it never doubled back on itself. That it, when it went to plus 2 centimeters, in the next week it go to plus 4 centimeters. That would be the appropriate, that would be the appropriate law for linear change at a sort of normally distributed rate. But that's not what we have. What we have is a process that's doubling back on itself furiously. And because it's doing that, you get this law that the variance goes up linearly, the standard deviation rises as a square root. Okay. So now it says, it reminds me to run a simulation for you. What I've got is a little R function, which I distributed. It's on the course website.
You want a chair?
No, I'll be fine, I think. It'll keep me awake. All right, let's see. I can do this if I go to the right. If I go into R, it's called plot OU up. And it has an argument. And the argument is the value of C. So if C is 0, then if C is 0, you're doing Brownian motion, because there's no pullback towards the optimal. If C gets larger, then you start to see the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process work. So let's start with Brownian motion. And we're going to, it'll run 10 lines. Now the catch is it's running tiny itty bitty ones. Let me make them bigger. I think I can get this. If I resize this, I think the question is whether it will, that will be inherited by the next. Suppose I now do that. Yeah, it stays the same size. Isn't that wonderful? Okay. So what we have is a horizontal scale, which is, now the problem we have, that we've had this many times before here, is for some reason R run on this machine gives you tiny little letters. This just says X, and these are values of X. This is 0. I believe it's like 0, 1, 2. The scale here goes from minus 2.5 to plus 2.5. What I've got is a time scale that's going up to 1 from, well, you can't even really see it clearly here, but there's a time scale going from 0 to 1. It's taking steps every 0.001, and it has a variance of each step of 0.001, which I chose arbitrarily, just didn't have a scale. So the standard deviation of the little jumps it makes at a grid of 0.001 is square root of 0.001. So it'd be about 0.03. And it's just, it's adding these up. And with no pullback towards the mean, it gets wider and wider. Now, it's not so obvious there, but if I do this, here it is again. Well, now you can see some of them have wandered down to here. I could do it for longer amounts of time. That would be probably the more. Here we go again. The question is, can you get a feel that the variance is going up? Now, remember, the standard deviation is not going up linearly. So when you're halfway there, the standard deviation is not half as big.
May I make a suggestion from Jean Parin a century ago? Just make the vertical axis the square root of time. That's the plot here on page 128.
Yeah.
If you make that the vertical axis, then that looks like a wedge.
Then it will look, as Fred said, it will look more, the spread, the standard deviation will be half as big halfway up, except you will change the time scale.
Yeah. Square root of time.
So I'm sticking to the regular time scale. And we see that it gets some wandering. Here's one where it wanders fairly far. And this is important because of what we're going to see as soon as we put in the
rubber band.
Yeah, the rubber band. The Brownian, I'm a little out of it, but so now here is going to be the optimum. Right now it's not paying attention to the optimum. Now let's put in the rubber band. Okay. So suppose that I put in 0.001. I checked some different values, and we do this. Okay. Well, now it looks somewhat similar. We have a small pull to the center. It's actually having an effect, but you can't really, it's not completely obvious. Let's do a few different replicates of that. Here it goes again. And again, some wandering out. The question is, will we see any cases where it gets as far? Remember that Brownian motion where it wandered almost the full width of the axis. These are a little bit more restrained, but it's not obvious. Now, if I double the strength of selection, if I try a 0.002, now you can see it's being fairly restrained. More restrained. And it's never kind of wandering out into these far regions. It's getting pulled towards the optimum, and it's going to end up sort of dancing around the optimum. If I strengthen the selection one more factor of 2, 0.004, now you see they're fairly constrained. Now each of these lineages here is independently doing its thing. They don't know about each other. They're not exchanging genes. They're not like populations that are related to each other and with individuals migrating between them. If they had migration between them, they will stay near each other, but they won't necessarily stay near the optimum. When you also have the optimum selection, when you have the optimum selection, everybody gets pulled to the optimum, and even though they don't have migration between them, they stay in the same vicinity, and that vicinity is the optimum. So let's do a few more of those. And you'll see they're really quite constrained compared to the Brownian motion. You know, just to emphasize that, if I get rid of the 4, go back to Brownian motion, here's Brownian motion again, and immediately you see it's wilder. So there's Brownian motion back again. The last 3 were 0, so they're Brownian motion. So you're welcome to, on your own time, take this little plot OU up and just play with it. And you can do other things. You can, what really would be fun, and I just ran out of time last night to get it going, is to make an array of these. At the way I have it working in the function is it just takes a single array of values, which are the value of a single lineage on this X scale, and it does it repeatedly and plots each line. But what really would be nice is to save those in an array with a different index for each of the lineages, and then compute the variance between, use the VAR function in R, and compute the variance and watch how the variance goes up. And what you ought to see, what you're in theory supposed to see, is if you take the variance among the X's, here's topic. In the Brownian motion, it just goes up on average linearly. In OU, it goes up
at asymptotes
at this value, which is variance of epsilon divided by roughly 2c.
I have to make a point that I, and stop me if you're ready to make it. Go back to the 004 case.
Just 004, hang on.
And from the formula that just went up on the board, since the step variance there was 001, and here 2c is 008, the variance of this little pipe you're looking at has to be the square root of 1/8. And you can actually find that on the horizontal scale.
Okay.
So
let's
that formula applies to that because we're already in the asymptotic case.
Yeah, the you can see actually that the wandering, it starts getting pulled back almost, you know, maybe down and around here in a noticeable way. And so all the rest of this is just the process dancing around the optimal.
What I'm saying, numerically.
Yeah, numerically.
Numerically, the square root of 1/8 is here at my pen, and that really is
The good estimate of variance, sorry, the standard deviation is the square root of my pen, and that really is running up the edge of this on both sides. So this formula is obvious in this picture.
I'm just trying to see if the...
Your step variance was 001, and 2C is 008.
The standard deviation, yeah, the variance is 0.001, and 2C is...
008.
Okay, so 0.001 over, yeah, okay.
It's 1/8.
You did it.
Yeah, and I square root of that.
The square root of 1/8
is roughly
0.35. 0.35.
And that's what I did with my pen.
Okay, I'm trying to take the square.
It's 1 over 2
yeah,
square
roughly,
root 2.
Something like that.
I'm the statistician.
Okay, so you did it faster than I did.
So
here is one unit, so 0.35 would be about here.
Yeah, it goes right up the middle of the
one standard deviation. That is plus or minus one standard deviation. It looks about right.
Yeah, well, it's precisely correct because this many generations is already well within the range for which your formula applies.
Yeah.
This is strong.
Well,
so this is strong.
I'll say, this is not a random sequence. This has a pseudo-random number generator. So this is precise. But anyway, it's not important. Okay. So there you see the effect of Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process in confining things to wandering in the vicinity of the optimal. So what I'm trying to persuade you is that the formulation of quantitative genetics leads to something that is essentially a Brownian, a random walk in discrete generations, a random walk which is a very close cousin of Ornstein-Uhlenbeck. In fact, it's essentially Ornstein-Uhlenbeck sampled at a discrete grid of points. So, and this is just to give you a little feel for that. So this is what's happening in one lineage where the optimum is sitting there and not doing anything. Let me go back to the projection and see.
That's also one variable. You're getting
it's one variable. That's one a point I will raise in a minute. Okay. So now I wanted to remind you of something which I did tell you about before. So I'm just going over slides you've seen before. And that is that the variation in covariation of change in characters I told you weeks ago comes from two. When you have more than one character, it's a multivariate normal process. Here it's occurring in two dimensions. There is covariation. That covariation comes from the genetic covariance. And it also comes, however, from this thing called selective covariance, which has to do with to what extent does natural selection is the change natural selection, in a sense, wants you to do covariate. So if you have two traits that have no genetic covariance genetically, but natural selection will want them both to increase at the same time or both to decrease at the same time, then that's selective covariance. Okay. So there are these two sources of covariation when we start to consider more than one trait. And likewise, even when we consider one trait, there is the genetic variance and the selective variance, the variation of what the selection differential is, which has to do with the variation of the slope of the fitness curve. Okay. I want to, in addition to reminding you of that, remind you that start to talk about some more complicated cases, and I just want to sort of mention them, but here's one that I feel is implied by this whole machinery, but nobody ever seems to talk about it, and I want to start the conversation. Suppose you have two traits that are genetically correlated, and one of them, number Y, trait Y, is under optimum selection, but the other trait is not. Now, this actually is modeling a situation where natural selection is trying to get a certain trait to its value, But the trait you're measuring is not that trait, it's something closely related to it. That might occur, for example, with a size measure. If you had a particular quantity that you were calling size, such as snout vent length, natural selection isn't really necessarily acting on that, it's acting on some other aspect of size. This is a model for that. And if we say, well, if this Y thing is under optimum selection, but X is the one we observe, what do we expect to see? And the answer is we expect Y to be pulled to its optimum, but we're not looking at Y. We're looking at the correlated character X. So it too will be pulled towards an optimum, but actually it will wander around it more than Y will. Because it has its own, in addition to the genetic drift involving the trait that you're not measuring, there is additional genetic drift involved that is specific to X, because X is not perfectly correlated with Y. So what you should see is a kind of weird combination, some sort of weighted average of an Orsky-Muhlenbeck process that's getting the size to the right value, and then this X thing that you're looking at is wandering around that. So it should, you know, everyone is all focused on the literature, the current literature of natural selection that between species level, people looking at phylogenies, and also the within population, literature on measuring selection in single natural population is focused on things like Orsky-Muhlenbeck processes. But if you consider the fact that we aren't necessarily measuring the same trait natural selection is measuring, it should be some kind of combination of Ornstein-Muhlenbeck and an added Brownian motion, which is the wandering of X around for a given value of Y sitting near the optimum. How much will X be able to wander? Fred?
An improvised response, since we never see variance that increases without limit in any species. Therefore, this can't happen. Therefore, X must also be under optimum selection.
Yeah.
And you just haven't said so. For real data, which will always be my mantra, there has to be some kind of selection on X, even if the strength of selection is weaker.
I want to make another related point, which is that we're talking about optimum selection. People sometimes will look at this and they'll say, well, if the fitness curve looks like this, then that's optimum selection. But, they must say, however, there's another possibility. You can, of course, have no selection, or you could have a fitness curve that went the other way. And then they will say, that is disruptive selection, which is a name given to it in the 1940s and 50s. And people will say, that's a possibility too. And what I wanted to argue is that no, it's not in practice. People say, oh, you could have disruptive selection, you could have an individual that's of intermediate size, but owing to the size of food items, it could be under selection to get a little bigger or a little smaller. There's some food that's bigger and there's some food that's smaller, but there's not too much food of intermediate size. Okay. They'll say, that could be disruptive selection. I just want to say, no, because pure disruptive selection would keep going up forever as you go off that way. And I can't think of any cases. Well, I can think of essentially no cases where the word essentially is being put in to be a hedge, because some of you might come up with cases. But generally speaking, if natural selection is trying to optimize the length of my forefinger, and it probably is weakly doing so, if it were disruptive selection, that would say I would be more fit the longer my forefinger were, indefinitely. If it were 100 feet long, that would be great for me. And I can't think of any biology that would actually do that. I believe that these curves actually look something like this. Disruptive selection, okay, everything's fine, and then...
Yeah, it looks like a dromedary.
It'll look like selection with two optima. I actually have a paper in 1979 called Excursions Along the Interface Between Disruptive and Stabilizing Selection. And what I basically did in that paper was set up a fitness curve that was a sum of two normal distributions. So it had a hollow in the middle, and the question was, under what circumstances did natural selection select you towards one of the two peaks, and under what circumstances did natural selection select you to go in the middle in between them? And there is a rule involving breeding values and such. I thought it was a cute paper. It's rarely cited. But I just wanted to point out that just casually standing and telling people that there is such a thing as disruptive selection, I challenge you to come up with a case in which a phenotype could go off indefinitely on an axis and get fitter and fitter and fitter. I don't think we're going to find cases.
If there ever was an example, it's human intelligence, and we just fell off the end a few hundred generations ago. That was almost selection toward infinity. But it's just stopped.
I see. Okay. Let me also remind you of the simulation I showed you earlier, and which we had in the first R exercise that we did. I had a case where you were doing this yourself, and you'll recall that here we had a situation where there are two characters. There's some genetic covariation which is negative between them. And so genetic drift will wander this way. And so for the first 100 generations, we see mostly that. But what I was assuming here is that there is a selective peak as well. There is optimum selection in both directions towards an optimum, which starts out here. But then I allow the optimum itself to wander. So this is selective covariance. And what happens is you see that if you look at an intermediate scale, so now you go 1,000 steps instead, the first 1,000 steps instead of the first 100 steps, and we plot 100 of them to every 10th generation, then it looks a little more circular. And if we keep going, we find that the values in different times, now this is 10,000 generations, sampling every 100, we find that most of the change in the character is where the peak wants it to go.
Because you've made that process Brownian rather than it's finding its own optimum at a longer time scale.
Yeah, in a longer time scale, if it stayed, say, in this square and wandered back and forth, it would look something like this, but it wouldn't go off indefinitely.
The simulation will go off indefinitely.
It will go off indefinitely. But I like the simulation because, and then the version that you got to do, because it makes the point that genetic covariation is not all, that there is this other thing called selective covariation, and people need to take it into account, and if they don't, they're really missing something. Okay.
So, I think what we're going to do is just finish off we'll finish a little early, so if people want to haul out your computers and run the OU process for yourself, you're welcome to. But let's see how far we get.
Can I have about 5 minutes after you're done?
Yeah, you can. You will help me greatly if you take five or even more. Okay, so some of the other issues that I want to ask you to think about, maybe I will ask you to think right now. One is, what about multivariate? I've been showing you mostly, I showed you a little bit of two-variable processes, but I've shown you mostly univariate processes. What about multivariate drift and selection? And the answer really is, here we saw additive genetic variance set the pattern for the Brownian motion if that was all that was going on. But if the optimum, if there is selective covariation as well, it doesn't follow that rule. And that really leads to the question about what happens if the peak moves. Okay, so, and generally the answer is the population will be chasing the peak. And it will chase it, and if it ever catches up, it'll wander around the peak. But often, if the peak were moving smoothly away, the population would tend to be dragged a little bit behind. And you can do, one can do variance and mean and covariance calculations that tell you to what extent the population will do that. What if the peak continues to move? Okay, so we have a moving peak, and the population is doing this Ornstein-Uhlenbeck trying to catch up with it. Now, the question is, what is a natural biological assumption for the process of movement of the peak?
Selection is changing.
Yes, selection is changing. Something is changing. So maybe temperature is increasing. That changes the optima for various characters. What? I mean, when we work on the phenotypic, the changes of the genotype and phenotypes, we are using Brownian motion and Ornstein-Uhlenbeck processes because they come out of the mathematics of genetic drift. And they come out of the mathematics of selection towards a simple optimal. Okay, that they're kind of natural. If I say, okay, I want to know how will the temperature is changing, how will the optimum length of my thumb reflect that temperature? Is there a set of a stochastic process that I could come up with that is the natural assumption for that? So I'll stare at you. It's a trick question. Yeah.
It's not Brownian motion, right? Because we're assuming that it seems like you're leading us towards this idea that fitness peak changes in specific ways. Like it's guided, it's not random.
It's guided by biotic interactions, what other organisms are doing. It's guided by environmental interactions, you know, what things like temperature are doing. But what I guess I'm going to say is, I don't know. You know, I'm asking you to solve a problem that I cannot solve for myself. Sure, you can assume Brownian motion if you want. Why? Because it's tractable. But I don't think there's any, you know, biological or physical law that says that Brownian motion is the natural assumption for how a selective peak moves. The selective peak could, in fact, stay the same place for a long time and then suddenly jump. And that's not, very much not, a Brownian motion. It's something else. So, at the moment, we have all this lovely mathematics, but at the heart of it, we're making some very arbitrary assumptions, particularly when we make assumptions about what the selective peaks are doing. We're really not... The closest we can come is to take measurements in different generations of where the peak is, which you can do by looking at the survival of individuals of different phenotypes, or their reproduction. And there's a whole bunch of people who do that. And then in principle, you could say, well, let's watch it for generation after generation and see what it does. That still begs the question of what it would do on a bigger time scale, because a time scale longer than the length of the average NSF grant.
The average investigator, I don't know.
Yeah, or the life of the NSF. You know, there is this example of the Illinois Corn Selection Experiment, which started in 1896 and has now been going on for 120 years, and a year is a generation for the Illinois Corn Selection Experiment. And they have put originally four different lines under selection for high protein, high fat, low protein, and low fat. I think they've lost one of their lines since then. They have 130 generations. And then, of course, we have Rich Lenski's very well-publicized long-term evolution experiment in bacteria, which is going even more generations. The Illinois Corn Selection Experiment has outlived multiple generations of
corn eaters.
Principal investigators. There's nobody still working on it who was alive at the beginning of the. At the beginning, in fact, they turned over. You know, every 20 or 30 years, the investigators completely turn over. But they keep it going because it's kind of fun. Okay. So then there's the issue I want to raise in this fourth point. Okay. You can think of a lineage following a peak. You could think about the issue, maybe not solve it, of what the peak, the process of movement of the peak would be in an abstract model. But then you have the question of, well, if this is to be thought about with multiple species, we're going to have a phylogeny. The forks in the phylogeny are going to be speciation events. And then the question comes, you can think about a whole bunch of species all attracted to the same optimum. That's possible. But there are biological reasons for thinking that those optima might not be the same. And one of them is the whole phenomenon called character displacement, where the fact that you, my sibling species, is eating large prey means I'm better off trying to eat small prey, basically. So, what happens to the optima that two species are attracted to at the moment of speciation and thereafter? Up to the moment of speciation, they might be either the same optimum, or maybe the optima have already started to pull apart. Maybe that has something to do with the speciation. But you could sort of say, well, I guess they're probably following, to some extent, different optima. How does that work? How different do the optima get soon after speciation? The short answer is, without knowing the whole story, without knowing the complete functional ecology of the characters that you're looking at and their environments, you're really not going to be able to know. No formulas that I give you, which are mathematically convenient, are going to necessarily be the true story. Now, what I think we're going to see is a lot of the literature hasn't really grappled with this. It is starting to grapple with multiple optima within a phylogeny. There are people saying, well, suppose that on each branch of the phylogeny, you can either stay at the same optimum or jump to a new, or have a new optimum. And then they try to fit that as a model. But it's still, that literature, which is in existence, is still at very early days yet. Because it's, there's not enough, basically because there's not enough biological realism yet put in.
Ah, biological realism.
Okay, I'm conceding there is such a thing, yeah. Okay, I just want to finish up by pointing out to you that some of this machine, some of the machinery I've been showing you, you can also think of it in terms of the breeder's equation. Now, this is really just it's just looking at the niceties of the algebra. It isn't making any new biological points. The breeder's equation was heritability times selection differential. If you have multivariate traits, if you have five traits instead of one trait, now you have matrices. You have a five-value selection differential. There's selection on every trait. Okay. You have a phenotypic covariance matrix P, and an additive genetic covariance matrix G. And it turns out that there's a multivariate version of the breeder's equation, which is a G P inverse. Yes. So the heritability, which is a ratio of the additive genetic variance to the additive genetic variance to the phenotypic variance, is replaced by G times P inverse, which for one dimension you can see is correct. You can multiply this by its transpose. You can take expectations through, and anyway, what you get in the end is that the response to selection, the covariation of response to the selection, the covariances of traits, is expressed in terms of this expression, which is GP inverse on this side, P inverse G on that side, and in the middle, a covariance-like thing, which is the reflects the covariance of the covariances of the selection differentials. I just want to show that, by the way, there could be another term for genetic drift, and I did not put that in. But what I just want to show you is you could rationalize in terms of all the usual breeder's equation things extended to multiple traits, the fact that the response to selection is a compromise between the genetic variation and the selective variation. And in the cases where I had those peaks wandering far, basically what was happening is that this term in the middle was getting bigger and bigger and dominating everything. And the genetic part was not having a very big influence. Okay, there are references at the end of the chapter, at the end of the projection is up on the website and up on the Catalyst site. One is my book, Inferring Phylogenies, where all this stuff is, versions of all this stuff are in chapter 23, which is just about gene frequency genetic drift, chapter 24, which is about quantitative traits undergoing selection and drift in populations. And then 25, which is about comparative methods. I also have a review article in 1988 that mentioned all this stuff. This is in a volume that Fred is also has papers in, a morphology, shape, and phylogenetics. I mentioned some of the same issues. This one will be hard to find because it's a symposium volume, and you have to go to the library and get the physical. Basically you'll have to get the physical book, because that's the thing about symposium volumes that is going to make them go extinct very soon.
But they're not.
Which
they're
is, not they're, they they're can't not be online. Not you can't, they can't be free online anyway.
Yep.
Publishers like Springer are starting to put their symposium volumes online, but at a considerable cost.
The solution is just to pirate them.
Well, in a court of law, they might force me to testify against
right.
you.
The
Russ Landy's paper that I mentioned, which is a classic, which is about a single trait dancing around an optimum, and he brings up the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck model and says that's the process to look at. And I think it's essentially the first mention of Ornstein-Uhlenbeck in the evolutionary literature. And so that's an absolute classic paper. For multivariate selection, here is a paper on brain body size allometry, which is, he's looking at two traits, and he's asking, to what extent does genetic drift, does the genetic covariation affect things? Similarly, in the 1918 paper, Bill Hill and Michael Lynch have a paper on what neutral mutation, in other words, pure genetic drift with mutation, no selection, what will happen. They have some algebra on that. Here are the two papers I think I already showed you that really were the first paper to mention selective covariation is Olaf Tedin's paper in German in the 1920s. I have looked at that paper and I cannot find where it does that, because it's A, it's in German, and B, it's written rather obscurely. I can read German, sort of, but this one defeated me. But Ledyard Stebbins cited it in 1950, but again, people didn't pay any attention for the next 40, 50 years. Scott Armbruster, in a paper in Journal of Evolutionary Biology in 1996, had talked about it, cited Stebbins and talked about it there, and that's really its reintroduction into the contemporary literature. And I have to tell a story that I reviewed one of his papers for publication, and in that paper he mentioned selective covariation. And I said, aha, there is a, so this has been noticed before. And I gave a talk at an evolution meeting, and I mentioned selective covariation. I didn't cite him. And he came up after the talk and he said, where did you get that? And I looked at his name tag. I said, who are you? And he said, Scott Armbruster. I said, I got it from you. And when I published it, and then I in the papers, that this was an earlier paper, so the 1988 paper, I did cite him.
And he got it from Stebbins, who got it from Tebbins.
He got it from Stebbins, who got it from Teddy. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, this is all the stuff I wanted to talk about. So Fred,
I'll be brief.
Yeah.
Because some of this is, I've published some of this. There's good reason to believe that fitness curves don't exist. except in actual breeding contexts, where the idea of the breeder's equation assumes a breeder who is a human, who is actually a farmer trying to optimize something like income. It certainly doesn't generalize to large numbers of variables. The geometers have known this. Sewell Wright was wrong. Wright was wrong in the graphics of the adaptive landscape. As the number of variables rises, even to as high as, even to as few as five, let alone 4,000 in geometric morphometrics, these peaks no longer are a characteristic of the geometry. And this model of an optimum as a point fails almost immediately. As a result, there is no equivalent of this kind of logic at all in the geometric morphometrics that I was giving you. We never talked about optimization except in the Procrustes sense of a statistical maneuver. There isn't any way to produce these notions in general in high-dimensional spaces. That is not a statement that they don't exist, but that there's a prior requirement that you be working on the true selective factors before you start, that you need to be in not a sketch on the board like where Joe started today, but in an actual biological situation like the one Joe started on today, where there are only two dimensions that matter and everything else is noise.
So you're saying that if you can get a level of looking at these underlying factors and identifying them.
And if they are few.
And if they are few, then you might actually find selective peaks.
You might find that a model of, you started with a fitness surface, and the assumption of a fitness surface is that it looks something like a quadratic form. And the more dimensions you have, the less likely it is that anything about it looks like a quadratic form.
Well, that's anything. Not saying that but it doesn't exist. That's saying it doesn't follow these nice Gaussian shapes.
No, it doesn't. It isn't describable by this kind of parabolic, paraboloidal variation in the vicinity of a peak. It just doesn't work like that. I'm making the point that Stuart Kaufman was making, that this, as the number of dimensions goes up, the utility of these models falls drastically, but there are many social contexts, including breeding, farming, where the number of dimensions isn't going up. So
yeah,
you look for situations where the number of dimensions is restricted.
As a matter of fact, I used to go talk to some, there was an outfit that used to be in the Seattle area called H&N. Or used to be called Heisdorf and Nelson, that was doing poultry breeding. They're actually located in Redmond.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're there anymore. Well, they got bought by some bigger outfit and moved somewhere else. But they used to, in their chicken lines, they had these huge poultry lines, and they had multiple ones, and they were doing very high-powered quantitative genetics on them. They had their own mainframe, and they were busy, and they were following in their artificial selection about 10 traits. So they were selecting for egg laying and so on, but they were also selecting for resistance to disease. They were trying to hold certain traits about, they were doing optimum selection of some traits. They didn't just select on one or two traits. Their selection index had lots and lots of things in it. The idea being that if they were able to move their line a substantial distance, it wouldn't become non-functional for some other reason. So artificial selection is less simple these days than perhaps the picture that I painted.
Yeah. Right, but also I'm saying this mental image of the idea of a fitness surface becomes a toxic fiction soon as the dimensionality rises.
Fred, we're going to have to put something.
No, I'm saying all of geometric morphometrics completely ignores this concept, and there's a reason for it, that you don't need this concept to actually describe collections of specimens.
I'm going to urge you that if you're looking at multiple species of phylogenies, that you should pay attention to this. There are people out there for a smaller number of traits who are trying to measure fitness surfaces within species.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's going to be a tension between the position you're taking and what they're doing. And I am less sure that we can discard the notion of a pen surface.
Well, then you might want to draw the line that high dimensional descriptions of morphology may not submit to this formalism in our lifetimes, in your lifetimes. High dimensional descriptions of some other aspects of living organisms, maybe, but everything in geometric morphometrics goes a long way without any talk at all about optima. It only talks about averages.
When we're looking at the way a form, for example, or shape, is changing on branches of a phylogeny, if we say, well, we can ignore selection, let's just assume it's a correlated Brownian motion, I worry that there really is some information there about selection constraining it.
But ignoring selection doesn't mean saying it's correlated Brownian motion. It means let us look at the data.
At the data by fitting models.
The difference. Okay. Yeah.
Well, yeah. No, yeah. The whole purpose of this course was so he and I could argue with each other.
But I want to ask Fred a clarifying question, which is there...
Can I lip read, please?
Yeah, in higher dimensional... in higher dimensional settings, is there a directionality to the selective pressure?
The concept...
Or does the concept the idea of directionality
the,
not
yeah,
exist?
The idea of directionality requires rejection of the fractal point of view. In higher dimensions, in real data, there always appear to be dimensions that are not usefully described by a differential, by a slope. The analogy you might want to the scientific field that's pushing this hardest is computational anatomy, in particular image in brains, for which the model of a high dimensional description fails even to describe the image, let alone the anatomy and the structure itself. There are always forms that are very close together that seem to be an awfully far distance apart on any descriptor you want, like a ratio, an angle, a fraction. And so you have to know in advance what the very few factors are. It might be what predicts intelligence and what predicts lifespan, like you were talking about in the eggs. It might be a small list, this many, of things that are important for the breeder. But to just throw the morphology out there and assume that what you get from 300 shape coordinates is something like what you get from height and width on a blackboard doesn't work in terms of the actual reification of your concept of a selective direction. In high dimensions, this model, their last slide, the GP inverse model, breaks down as a recipe for getting a direction. For instance, as soon as your matrices are bigger than your sample size, you can't invert P anyway.
Well, that's in a sense a separate issue. I think that's a somewhat separate issue.
Somewhat?
Separate issue.
Oh, no, not to the data. The data analyst will always say, I want to say something about data. And the biomathematician over there will say, I want to say something about models. And the point I'm making here is that this language of models does not appear to be easily translated into the data analyses of landmark-driven morphometrics of GML. Well, these surfaces don't go up in dimension the way you want them to.
To be continued.
To be continued, yeah.
Yeah.
But then in the phrase breeder equation, remember, the breeder is a human being who's paying a mortgage. This is not Darwin, the breeder. Well, Darwin was breeding pigeons.
Darwin was very, very much in contact with breeders.
Yeah, they were the fitness of pigeons was a basis of which pigeons the breeders allowed to mate, and that's not exactly a Darwinian fitness.
I better let everybody get out of here. Okay, so next time, all you're doing, will people object if I record the session? In part, it might be helpful to Claire, who has to miss the session, so if we put it up on the site, then even though it's you guys who are speaking, not me, she'll get a sense of what was done.